E3.
Okay, let's just do that then, and then I'll keep working on this, I guess.
Yeah. All right, let me get some adjustments here. It's a little loud. All right, that looks good. Okay. It's recording, and I'll just send you all the raw audio.
Can you see me? Can you see me too, or no?
Yeah, I see you.
Okay, cool.
For the great Pink Floyd the Wall poster.
Yeah. All right, I'm just getting my. I don't need my. Yeah. Okay. So how you been, man?
Really good. Busy as hell. The rest of 2016, every weekend is like booked, and this election night coverage is just it's going to be huge. So biggest show I've ever been a part of.
Cool. Well, we'll talk all about that once we're going.
Okay.
Let me read a little intro and then we'll get going.
Okay.
Greetings, cannabis enthusiasts, and welcome to another edition of Blazin'. As always, I am your host, Bobby Black. Well, Election Day is just 1 week away, folks, bringing to a close the longest, craziest, and nastiest campaign season in our lifetimes. Despite his abrasive, divisive, and dangerous rhetoric, or perhaps because of it, not to mention the allegations of sexual assault, misconduct, and the total lack of support from the GOP, polls indicate that Republican nominee Donald Trump somehow still stands a chance of becoming our next president. And even if he loses, it seems likely that at best, he'll challenge the outcome of the election, or at worst, lead some sort of armed revolution of right-wing militias, a revolution that will, without a doubt, be televised. But as we watch this reality show circus of a political process unfold, it's important that we as cannabis users don't lose our faith or focus, as there are a staggering 9 states, I believe, 9 states with various marijuana legalization measures on the ballot, which, if passed, will surely hasten our march towards the end of pot prohibition. Oddly enough, though, there are some segments of the cannabis community that are actively working against some of these measures, causing a schism amongst stoners almost as bad as that between the Democrats and the Trumpeteers. With me today to break it all down, discuss the various measures, and try to make sense of it all is quite possibly the smartest and hardest working journalist in the cannabis media today. He's logged over 3,000 podcast hours and 400 published writing credits as a controversial columnist for High Times, my old job, as well as Huffington Post and other outlets. He's also the former head of Oregon Normal and host of the Russ Belville Show on Cannabis Radio. My friend, Radical Russ Belville. How's it going, Russ?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on the show, Bobby. Nice talking to you.
It's a pleasure to have you. Yeah, I'm sorry it's taken this long, but I'm happy to have you here right before the big election. You've been doing a lot of coverage online. I've noticed. I've been following it. I've been following both sides of this issue, particularly in California, very closely. And I've been torn a bit. But, what I'd like to do actually in this show is I'd like to spend the first half of the show, the first 15 minutes or so, discussing all the initiatives that are going on around the country and the election in general. And then after the break, come back and discuss and focus on California and on Alma. That's cool.
Yeah.
So tell me, what have you been up to besides generating hilariously sarcastic memes that mock the forces against legalization?
Well, I'm preparing for the election night. I'm hosting 6 hours of live coverage on cannabisradio.com. And we're doing this, you know, like CNN or MSNBC or Fox would do an election night show and have all the polls count down and get the latest election results in and have the video screen. That's what we're going to do. But we're going to do that for all the marijuana reform measures that are on the ballot, and not just the 5 legalization and the 4 medical ones that are statewide. But there's decrim measures in Ohio. There's tax measures in Washington, bans in Oregon, social use initiative in Denver. There's a whole lot of news to cover, and that's what we're going to be covering.
Cool. Well, let's jump right into some of that then. I'm not aware of every single decrim bill that's going on in the country, but I am aware of the major ones in the states. I know Nevada, Maine, Arizona, Massachusetts, Florida, Arkansas, Montana, North Dakota, and of course California all have various laws, some like medical, as you said, some full adult use legalization. Let's do like a quick breakdown. A lot of them have a lot of similarities, it seems. Possession of 1 ounce for adults seems to be a fairly standard thing across the board. 21 and over, obviously, is a pretty standard thing across the board. But they each one varies a little bit from state to state in what they allow. Also, 6 plants seems to be it now apparently the agreed upon amount that's allowed for legalization to grow for yourself. Where did they get that number
from? It's a magic, you know, half dozen. That sounds good. That sounds right.
Yeah. And of course, there's all the vagaries involved in all of these things, such as do clones count as 6 plants? Are they mature plants or immature plants? There's all these little gray areas that need to be fleshed out, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. And there are some differences with the different initiatives out there. You mentioned the standard of it being kind of a 1 ounce thing. A lot of folks don't realize it's kind of a sleeper, but up there in Maine, they've got an initiative that's going to be one of the, if not the most liberal of the legalization states. They've got 2.5 ounces that they're going to be allowing, including concentrate. So you can have up to 2.5 ounces of concentrate in the state of Maine.
I was like, oh. They don't even differentiate between the two.
No, yeah. Just basically, it's whatever you have, you can have 2.5 ounces of it. So it could be concentrate, flower. If you got edibles, the edibles could only have up to 2.5 ounces in the edibles and so forth.
Okay, so they're not counting the weight of the edible, though.
Yeah, we don't know. that's one of those things in the initiative where they say they don't. It's kind of not said, so it's probably up to a court to decide when someone gets busted for it.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately the case, or fortunately the case, in some, you know, with most of these laws. So let's just do a quick rundown. Like I said, in Nevada, one of the things I noticed that was different in the Nevada bill is that you're only allowed to grow if you do not live within 25 miles of a marijuana store. I mean, is that what it says? That's kind of weird.
Yeah. Of these five, if Maine is the one that's most liberal, Nevada is the one that's most conservative. It's got what they call a 25-mile halo. If there's a pot shop, draw a circle 25 miles around that. And if you live within that circle, you don't get to home grow. Well, in Nevada, that's going to be everybody in Vegas, everybody in Reno, everybody in the major urban areas. And then, you know, the only people that can home grow are going to be living out there in Lovelock or Ely or some way out in the desert place. So that's unfortunate. Nevada also has the highest public toking felony. If you get caught, or felony, a penalty, I should say, $600 misdemeanor. So if they catch you out smoking a joint on the strip or something, misdemeanor, $600 fine. So that's pretty punitive.
Yeah, and it's weird because you would think Nevada would be one of the most liberal, considering it's, you know, Vegas is known as a city of vice, and you know, so you would think that they would be pretty open to that. I've heard rumors that they're going to have a sort of a green light district or something of that nature in Vegas, where people will be able to get and consume cannabis either in casinos or near casinos or in you know, like in part of that whole Vegas vibe.
Yeah, and Nevada's a special case politically in that you have the great influence of the casino industry, hotel, tourism, and alcohol. Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, has donated $1 million or so bucks there in Nevada. You've got the like the MGM Sands or Grand, a couple of the other casinos. The beverage distributors actually were written into the initiative to be the distributors of cannabis, specifically to try to keep them from being opposing of the initiative. So there's a lot of influence of alcohol and casino going on there.
Well, that's an interesting dynamic. I know that in some other states, Washington and in your state of Oregon, the Liquor Control Board has been a big hurdle for a lot of, especially for cannabis events, but for other reasons, because they were put in charge of the cannabis regulation, and they're not doing maybe the best people to be in charge of it.
Right. You know, marijuana ain't alcohol. And the people with the mindset of dealing with a harmful, dangerous, addictive drug that, you know, causes a lot of mayhem in society. If you got that mindset going into trying to regulate cannabis, that's where you come up with, you know, you can only have 6 plants in an ounce. So you're still thinking it's some sort of dangerous substance. So that's been difficult. But more difficult sometimes is convincing people there should be a new bureaucracy added in addition to what we've already have to deal with as taxpayers. You know, most people don't smoke pot. They just think government waste. And so turning it over to the liquor boards in some cases is a political decision to be able to just get it passed. But you're right. It should be separately regulated. It's a different sort of substance.
And in contrast to that, Maine, which you just referenced, if I'm not mistaken, they put the Department of Agriculture and Forestry yeah. in charge of it, which is a different way to go for sure. I don't know. I guess, I mean, are they equipped to deal with that? And is that a better option?
You know, it's worth attempting. You know, the Justice Louis Brandeis once said the states are the laboratories of democracy. Well, let's have some more experiments. Let's see what happens if an agriculture department regulates a plant. What wouldn't that be interesting, right? And yeah. the people in Maine seem to get it more as far, at least through this initiative, seem to get it more as far as the agricultural aspect. You mentioned the six plant thing. In Maine, their initiative is going to allow 6 mature plants, 12 immature plants, and an unlimited number of seedlings. So that's even more progressive than any of the other states at this point.
Yeah, that's pretty progressive. And then, so let's keep running down the list. Arizona has Proposition 205, the Legalization and Regulation of Marijuana Act. Once again, we're dealing with 1 ounce, a taxed and regulated recreational industry, 6 plants, pretty standard stuff. I think, and I don't know if the other states are this, but in Arizona, the plants have to be grown inside of a locked space indoors. It is not, do any of these states really, it seems like most of them are only allowing cultivation if it's indoors.
It varies. That's usually the presumptive minimum is like in the California Act, the Prop 64, they're going to guarantee that you can grow 6 plants indoors, but whether or not you can grow outdoors is subject to the locality and other zoning and regulations. So at least indoor is being protected. And when it is, you have to usually have it, you know, out of public view and in a locked and closed space.
Right. And then also in Arizona, they're going to be creating one of those bureaucracies that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. They're going to be creating a new Department of Marijuana License and Control, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think maybe having an organization that's specifically targeted and fine-tuned to the issues and problems of the cannabis industry, which is a unique industry, is probably a good thing.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And there's some other interesting things about Arizona. There was a donation of $500,000 from a pharmaceutical company that makes fentanyl, you know, the drug that killed Prince, Michael Jackson and such. Or no, that was propofol yeah. with Michael Jackson. Yeah. But this drug manufacturer is also working on development of a synthetic cannabinoid medicine. So they're donating to try to stop legalization. The discount tire company gave $1 million. So a lot of things are happening in Arizona, and it's interesting in a couple of ways. They come up with a couple of protections that we need to have in our legalization laws. Protections for child custody and family court, that you can't be discriminated against just because you're a cannabis consumer and lose your kids or visitation or anything like that. And the protection for organ transplants. You know, they kick people off a waiting list if they find you've got metabolites in your system. That would be protected under the Arizona law. And they are protecting our rights to drive by insisting in the law, it's written in a way that says you can't be punished solely for having metabolites or even active metabolites in your system. They're going to have to prove impairment, as they should.
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the criticisms, of course, in Colorado and some of the other states that have legalized so far, is that 0.5 microgram rule. Yeah. Nanogram, which is ridiculous. I mean, you could have that in your system if you smoked days ago, right? And you wouldn't even be high.
Absolutely.
And how is that in any way, by anyone's measure, a fair gauge of whether you're impaired? It's silly.
Exactly.
It's not silly for the people that get arrested and put in prison.
No.
That's not silly. But, you know, I'm just saying it's an absurd standard. So let's and then finally, all right, and then we have Massachusetts, which is question 4. And I know you were just recently at the Boston Freedom Rally.
Yep.
Covering it. It's been a few years since I've been able to go to the Boston Freedom Rally. I miss it. It's such a fun event. A lot of good people up there. I know that question is also a bit contentious. Like California, there are activists that are against question 4, are there not?
Yeah, it's not as vocal, and I don't think as many at this point. I think there's it's subsided more in Massachusetts, and it's increased more in California. The Massachusetts one, like you said, has pretty much, like the rest of them, 6 plants to grow with a household limit of 12. But one thing they do a little different with their grow, all the rest of them, and this is something that, you know, Oregon and a couple of, at least Washington could add, is the ability to possess the results of your harvest. Here in Oregon, you're allowed to have 4 plants, which is, you know, tough, and 8 ounces. Well, okay, so I'm only growing 2 ounces per plant? I mean, Bobby, I'm no grower, but I can do 2 ounces a plant, okay? So this, the results of the harvest rule is what they have in Colorado, which is when you harvest, as long as you're keeping it at the grow site, you can have that. And I've always theorized that that's really an infinite limit, isn't it? Officer, this 200 pounds is the results of my harvests all over the years, right? But the ones they have this in all 5 of the ones voting. But Massachusetts is different because it's results of the harvest and 10 ounces, which means even if you don't grow, you can have 10 ounces at your home.
Oh, see, because I saw the 10-ounce part, and I thought maybe when you said the results of the harvest that they were limiting the results of the harvest to the 10 ounces, but that's in addition to the harvest.
In addition to. So that takes, you know, for someone here in Oregon that is caught with, 8 ounces in their house, but they don't grow, well, could they be subject to penalty then? Because that's not a result of any harvest. You'd always have to be able to prove that you'd been growing. Not in Massachusetts. You can have at least 10 ounces even if you're not growing.
Wow. So what are the big objections to the question 4 in Massachusetts? And again, we will get to the California mm-hmm. law and the objections to that in the second half of the program, everybody. But for now, what is the objections in Massachusetts to question 4?
Part of it stems from there being 2 groups, 2 initiatives that had been working. The one, this CRIMLA, they call it, Campaign for the Regulation of Marijuana Like Alcohol. And then there's Bay State Repeal, which was the more grassroots supported and more liberal of the two, and it didn't make the ballot. And so what happens is some people think that they're deciding between which of those two we like better instead of are we choosing between legalization and prohibition. And so some of the people have come around to that now and realize that, okay, at least question 4 is better than, you know, continuing prohibition. Other people tend to disagree with these things on arcane kind of, you know, regulatory matters, that this fee is too high or this tax is too problematic, which isn't really so much a concern in Massachusetts. They're going to have the lowest tax of any legal state. It's something like 6% total when you add it all up. But it's always something, and it's sometimes hard to understand where it's coming from. I can't understand people that would want to continue the power of police to be able to upend our lives over the smell of marijuana. And it just baffles me.
Yeah. I'm kind of with you on that. I definitely think that there are, you know, a lot of laws have some downsides and some negative points to them that I can understand the objections. But overall, I would say unless it's a terrible law, like I believe Ohio's was a couple of years ago, that one I think I was kind of most people were happy didn't pass. But most of them, I would say I would, you know, be in favor of supporting. Let's just quickly go through the medical initiatives that are on the ballot as mm-hmm. well. So in Florida, we have Amendment 2, and that is to provide for medical use of marijuana for individuals with debilitating medical conditions. Is that just a standard medical marijuana law? Is there anything unusual about it?
I don't believe the Florida law has home grow in it. I think this is one of these dispensary laws, but they will be able to have access to the whole plant, unlike what we've seen transpire in some of the new medical marijuana states like New York, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania. The condition list is pretty standard as far as the big 8, cancer, cachexia, AIDS, the nausea, seizure, spasm, pain, those sorts of conditions. And beyond that, no, there's not much different from it as far as your standard medical marijuana law. It's better than a lot of the ones that have been passed on the East Coast recently.
Yeah, and the other thing that's always been something that I've been very interested in is I've been a kind of a champion for veterans in medical marijuana when I was working at High Times and hosting the veteran panels and stuff. And are we seeing more of these medical laws starting to take PTSD into account, or really not so much?
No, they are. The more and more states are adding post-traumatic stress to their condition lists, and they're continuing to recognize that. It's getting a lot of traction now among the veterans community and within our Congress. There has been a significant move through my Congressman Earl Blumenauer and others who are pushing for that for the VA doctors to be able to recommend. It's something that had passed both houses, the House and the Senate, but in reconciliation and the final bill got stricken somehow. And so we still don't have that protection for our veterans.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. I know that there were some big champions. I know Cory Booker and Kristen Gillibrand fought for the CARES Act, I believe it was.
That's right, the CARES Act.
And you know, it seemed like there was getting a lot of momentum and support for it. And I really hope that it continues to move forward because, so far the evidence was mostly anecdotal from veterans, but there has been medical evidence now starting to build up to show why cannabinoids are so good for PTSD by helping veterans forget the things that are keeping them awake and causing them trauma and enabling their brains to kind of defocus from that and let go of that. And I know from personal experience, just all the vets that I've been spoken to or had the fortune of having on my panel, they all say it's saved their life, basically. It saved them from suicide in some cases.
Yes, I've heard that so much myself as well. And that's why we have to move forward at the state level if the federal government's not going to move. We're going to pull them into this eventually.
Absolutely. So also we have North Dakota, which is, again, seemingly a pretty standard medical marijuana law, allows up to 3 ounces of possession. And then they do allow you to grow your own there, as well as get from dispensaries, it seems like. And then there's a couple of unusual ones. Montana is actually voting to reinstate the medical marijuana law that they already passed and that was stricken down. Initiative 182 or something?
That's right.
What happened with that whole thing? They had medical marijuana. It was going and then somehow it got shut down.
Montana is just the most roller coaster story. It begins when they pass medical marijuana in 2004. They have a standard, you know, you can grow some cannabis, you can possess it, you can have a caregiver who grows it and helps you out with it. And like other states in the West, like Washington, California, they stretch that meaning of caregiver to be, hey, I grow marijuana and have a whole bunch of it, and here at my counter in my store, you can come buy some. That was never really written into the Montana law, but soon enough, you had these storefront caregivers that were distributing cannabis to these patients. And of course, once access was possible, there were more and more patients. And eventually, their caregiver or their patient roles grew to about 30,000 patients. They had numerous, like 1,000 or so, 1,400 caregivers, you know, growers who were supplying medicine. And in reaction to that, and also in reaction to some other scandalous stuff going on with doctors and Skype exams and things that looked kind of shady to the general Montana population, the legislature passed this law that completely gutted their... Actually, they started by repealing the medical marijuana law, and that made it to the governor's desk, but the governor vetoed it. So then they passed a law that basically gutted the medical marijuana law, and the governor let that one become law without his signature. And it mandated that a caregiver could only care for 3 patients, and any doctor that recommended for more than 25 patients a year would be audited by the medical board. Well, in reaction to that, dispensaries closed down, patient rolls went from 30,000 to 13,000, registered caregivers dropped, and this was subject to a lot of court challenges, went through a lot of battles, but the final result was the Montana Supreme Court just this year upheld all of it. And as of September, all those people that were getting medicine from all those different caregivers, about 9 out of 10 of them just lost their grower. And that's where they're at now. Initiative 182, if it passes, would restore that medical marijuana program back to the way it was, where there could, and explicitly define that there would be dispensaries to take care of these patients in Montana.
Okay, so that's a real important one that we should really be rooting for. It sounds important. I know those people in Montana are probably sick and tired of all that runaround and waiting and trying to figure it out and stuff. And then finally, another kind of confusing one seems to be Arkansas, because they have 2 different issues on the ballot and that are, I don't know if they're somewhat conflicting, but I was a little confused reading about it. Well, maybe you can clarify.
Yeah, there is brand news, breaking news on this. There may be 2 of them on the ballot, but only one of them will be voted on. There is issue 6 and issue 7, and the Arkansas Supreme Court decided yesterday that issue 7 is stricken from the ballot because there was a problem with their signature gathering. That was brought about by a lawsuit by a Normal Legal Committee lifetime member in Arkansas named Kara Benka. And her lawsuit was successful, and it was backed by the issue 6 people helping her out to defeat this other, get this other initiative off the ballot. The issue 7 was a more liberal one. It had like 56 qualifying conditions, allowed people with hardship exemptions to be able to grow their own cannabis. Issue 6 is stricter, has fewer conditions, doesn't allow any home grow, and it's the only one that will be voted on at this point.
That's unfortunate, and it highlights the schism within the cannabis community that I want to address in our second segment. So what we're going to do is now we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, and we will be right back with more of the Blazin' Election Special with Radical Russ Belville. All right, and we are back. Welcome back to our special election edition. My guest today is renowned cannabis journalist and podcaster, Radical Russ Belville. Welcome back, Russ.
Thanks, Bobby.
So in the first half, we were talking a lot about all the different initiatives that are going on around the country for cannabis legalization, medical, decriminalization, all that stuff. And now I want to kind of focus on the big one because you know, I'm out here in Cali now and Southern California. Happy to be out here after spending a lot of time in my whole life in New York, which is not the most cannabis friendly place, at least not legally. So here out here we have Prop 64, the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, or as it's lovingly referred to, ALMA, or not so lovingly. There's a giant schism going on with this one. I don't know if it's divided in half necessarily, but it seems like more people are for it than against it. But the people who are against it have been very vocal. I want to do a breakdown of this law. And you did a great piece online that I read that really helped clear up a lot for me because I've been on the fence about this myself. You know, my natural inclination is always to be for legalization, but I was reading so many negative things about it from people I respect, not just crackpots and wingnuts, but people I respect in the community having real issues with it and saying that it would be a disaster. So you know, as an educated voter and as a person, a thoughtful person in the cannabis community, I don't want to just blindly, you know, rubber stamp some law. I want to understand it and read it before I cast my vote. So I've been doing a lot of research on it and, you know, listening to people, voices on both sides of the issue that I respect. But your piece kind of really I call it the marijuana mythbuster. You're kind of like the marijuana mythbuster in a way. You really broke down a lot of the criticisms and kind of countered them. So I want to go through that. First of all, let's just start off by saying who is for this, or more importantly, who is against this bill?
Who is for this bill is a list of all of the major marijuana reform organizations on the national level as well as within California. We've got also the ACLU of California as well as the NAACP of California endorsing the measure. The Lieutenant Governor, Gavin Newsom, who's been a strong champion of changing these laws, has been in front of this issue as well. We've got the California Democratic Party and the Green Party, the LGBT Democratic Club, a couple of them, a lot of great social justice supporting types of organizations. Then you look on the other side and it's cops. It's cops and DAs and a bunch of city councils that have banned marijuana and Project Sam, you know, Kevin Sabet's organization sitting there, tons of chiefs of police and so forth.
Right. Well, that's the usual suspects. So Who are the unusual suspects? You brought up Kevin Sabet, and I noticed you posted a commentary about there was a news conference on October 27th at the Hilton in San Francisco. And you pointed out that here was Kevin Sabet, the leading voice, basically the modern day Harry Anslinger, mm-hmm. standing there in shaking hands with and support of with marijuana medical marijuana business owners and groups like Stoners Against Legalization, which is an oxymoron. I mean, really. So what's going on there? Who are these people that are standing with the prohibitionists against this bill?
Yeah, Kevin Sabet recruited some people among these medical marijuana and other folks in California that oppose Proposition 64 that are also cannabis consumers for this photo op, this press op at the in San Francisco. And they are, well, they include folks like Letitia Pepper, who's a Riverside attorney. It includes Dennis Perrone, the famous, you know, one of the co-authors, the founder of this medical marijuana movement in San Francisco, Prop 215. Steve Cubby is involved. There's many people who've contributed to this. But the people that were there at the event were Jamie Kerr from the 530 Collective in Shasta and Sean Kiernan from the Weed for Warriors Project. And a couple other folks whose names escape me at the moment. Now, I've got, of course, my disagreement with people that are against Prop 64, but that's one thing. To give aid and comfort to abet Kevin Sabet, a man who has said that medical marijuana programs are a joke, who has demeaned and insulted us regularly in the media, to stand with him and help him, to be a knowing prop for him, that just went beyond the pale for me.
It's a new low, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, obviously Dennis Perrone is a very respected figure in the community. He's someone that is a lifelong crusader, you know, and, you know, you would think that he doesn't, you know, I know a lot of the opposition, it seems to me, much like with Prop 19, is that there's a lot of people that stand to lose a lot of money. Mm. Growers, small growers, possibly dispensary owners. So there's people that have financial, selfish financial reasons for wanting this to not go through. But those aren't the only people that right. are opposing it. There are other people that are opposing it on principle. And I would think that maybe Dennis might be one of those people. Is there argument that it just doesn't go far enough? Because that seems to be like the big argument I've heard before. It's like with Prop 19 is, oh, it's not real legalization because it doesn't go far enough. And are these people, are they really allowing the perfect to become the enemy of the possible? You know, is there real legitimate, you know, problems with this?
Well, there have been folks that have been bamboozled into this thinking that passing Prop 64 leads to the end of Prop 215. Nothing could be further from the truth. There will still be medical rights. You can still do that whole thing. But on a larger scale, I think that there's just this underlying fear of change that's involved in it for some people. Like, you're right. It's not all people that are just making a buck off this that stand to lose. It's also people that think that it's going to somehow harm what's going on now. It's going to harm the status quo. And if you're in California, the status quo seems pretty good. You can go get your card from just about anybody. You can go shop at these dispensaries. Depending on where you live, you can grow. So things seem pretty good, and they're worried that that's going to end somehow. Well, legalization in the long run should end medical marijuana. The whole point of medical marijuana was the patients are getting arrested and convicted. If we legalize it enough, eventually, then nobody gets arrested and convicted, and there'll be no point for medical marijuana at that point. It'll just be marijuana. But how do we get there? Well, they think we can jump there. We can just jump right to that point. And I don't think that's possible. I think all social change throughout the history of the United States, and for the most part, the world, has been a slow accumulation of rights, a slow accumulation of changes. I liken these people that want to reject Prop 64 because it's only an ounce and six plants and it doesn't quite go far enough to people who would have rejected the Emancipation Proclamation because it didn't legalize interracial marriage. We'll get there. You got to go step by step.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incremental. It has to be. I really don't see any other way for it to. You have to. I mean, look how long it's taken for public opinion just to reach the level it is now supporting marijuana. It's been generations. And it's been a lot of obviously having to overcome lots of misinformation and propaganda and all this other stuff, which is finally, you know, falling by the wayside. But, yeah, things happen in steps, you know. The same thing can be – yeah, like you said, with slavery and the civil rights movement, I mean, there's Rosa Parks. There's, you know, forced integration of schools. There's the lunch counter sit-ins. There's one step at a time fighting for every inch of ground. And we're winning. I mean, it's going well.
Yeah.
But we're still – that doesn't mean the fight's over and that, yay, we're here. You know, it's still going to be a struggle, and this is a step. But let's break it down a little bit. I mean, it goes down – it goes basically like this. Again, the 1 ounce allowed of flower or 8 grams of cannabis concentrate, cultivation of up to 6 plants. Again, this seems to be the standard that everyone's agreed upon for some reason. Also, industrial cultivation of hemp is allowed, I see, which is actually a really cool thing. Great. California's filled with farms, and I'm sure that there's a lot of farmers that would love to maybe grow some hemp. And then so there's a lot of positive things in the law. Give me a little rundown of some of the other good things in the law.
Okay. I do want to clarify, when you say the 6 plants, it is a limit of 6 plants per household. And that's something some people complain about, but I always have this attitude on the 1 ounce and the 6 plants. How are they going to know? How is it that when it was completely illegal and we could be put in cages, if the cops even smelled some weed, we were still growing in our closets. We were still growing in our basements. We were still possessing quarter pounds. But now that it's going to be legal and all the drug dogs that sniff weed will be retired and the smell of weed is no longer probable cause to start a search or a police investigation, how is it going to be worse? Grow what you're growing, man. When 6 plants are legal, that's going to be a lot harder for them to find 12. So that's one thing. But other good things in the law I like about Prop 64 is the ability for there to be licensing of pot lounges, cannabis cafes, or even special events, like, say, I don't know, a cannabis cup or something. You could have an actual license for that. So that would be nice to have. But I got to say, the number one selling point for me on Prop 64 that none of these other laws are doing, and Oregon's came close. We've got this method for expungement and such. But in California, they're reducing all of these grow felonies, all these sales felonies, except the ones that are aggravated, you know, if you sold it to kids, right, or, you know, burnt up the forest or something, right? But your basic grow felonies, your basic sales felonies, possession with intent felonies, get reduced to misdemeanors retroactively. So that
That's
means
important.
people who are felons now, who've got that black mark on their record that prevents them from buying guns or getting jobs or whatever else, become misdemeanors and can be expunged from their records. People who were caught growing 6 plants or fewer, that becomes legal. They have no record at all anymore. People who are sitting in cages right now for 2, 3, or 4 years for a California grow felony get that sentence reduced to 6 months, credit for time served, and get out when Prop 64 passes. That's the best thing for me.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things I always go to when people talk about legalization and how, oh, we've been making so much progress. And again, I always go back to, you know, until the people that are in prison can get out, we haven't made enough progress, because these people's lives have been destroyed over a plant. And, you know, I guess a lot of these people who are opposed to Prop 64 maybe never spent time in prison for cannabis, because maybe if they did, they'd feel differently. I know that our friend Todd McCormick, who has been a lifelong activist and did spend time in prison for cannabis, is very much for Prop 64 and has been speaking out, you know, he's been a big vocal proponent of it for many reasons. But the main one, I would think, being that, you know, he knows what it's like to be in there. He knows what it's like to have your life destroyed and have to live in a cage. And he doesn't wish that on anybody. And the opportunity to not have any more people be put in prison, and even better, like you said, having the people that are already in there be let out, you know, is really a big deal. And it's very important. Yeah. I mean, Obama's done he's granted a lot of clemencies, probably more than any other president in our lifetime. But it's not enough. There's still a lot of people in there. And I know our friend Sherry Sicard, who runs the Marijuana Lifer Project, will tell you there's still people in prison for life for marijuana, which is absurd. So, yes, please, let's pass some laws to get these people out of prison.
Yeah, I had a response on social media from that Jamie Kerr, who was there with Kevin Sabet at that event, who admitted that the 10% of 64 that was restorative justice for felonies was a good thing, but she couldn't support the other 90%. And I just, when, you know, I spent 6 hours in a jail for possession once, and that was 6 hours too many. I wear this medal from my friend Bobby Platshorn, who spent 29 years in a cage over marijuana. And these people in California that think they've got it so good, they're medical, everything's fine, we don't need to change anything, forget that not only in California are there 8,800 felonies arrests every year in that state, but throughout the rest of the United States, there are tens and hundreds of thousands of these arrests. And places like Alabama and Ohio and Florida and Texas, they aren't going to legalize until California starts knocking that door down on the federal government. So you've got to think broader than just your own narrow, what's happening in my little place in California. California is the keystone to ending this. It's the key to ending the war on drugs on not just the United States, but the whole global level. And to think that we could give California a second straight defeat in this century for legalization, to give Kevin Sabet the biggest victory he could ever wish for, I just breaks my heart.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame. California is the one of the largest economies in the world. You know, it's obviously one of the biggest, if not the biggest, cultural influencer of the United States. You know, possibly you could argue New York as well. But I mean, it is a huge, I mean, everybody looks to Hollywood, to California, to, you know, and aside from that, the fact that California has been historically the place for pot in America. I mean, the best growers in the country have always come from the Emerald Triangle, Northern California. I mean, this is wine country. This is great pot growing climate, you know. Yeah. So the fact that California has fallen so far behind Colorado in some respects is kind of embarrassing as a cannabis person in California. Like, we need to get with the program. We need to start moving forward. And they also recently just passed the MRSA. Yeah. Which is the Marijuana Regulation and Safety Act, which is starting to put all these regulations in place. And there are people that were bitching about that, too. But in all honesty, I mean, how do these people think pot's going to be legalized without regulation and without money being made from it? Because if that's your objection that, oh, it's too regulated and there's too many companies making money off of it. What is legal in the United States that companies aren't making money on? I mean, how are you going to – in what world do you think you can stop that?
Well, exactly. You know, who thought cannabis was going to be immune to the laws of supply and demand and the rules of economics, right? But some people did. They really thought that legalization meant we keep doing everything we've been doing with no taxes, no regulations, no inspections, no nothing. And we sell it at $300 an ounce to each other, but the cops can't bust us. That's what they thought legalization was. Well, no, once something's a legal commodity, it's subject to all of economics. And I think some of these people's complaints about Prop 64 or legalization in general are really complaints about capitalism, which I agree with a lot of those complaints. But my point in legalizing weed isn't to solve racism or capitalism or income inequality. It's to stop people from being messed with by the cops and going to jail over weed. That's the only problem I need to solve.
Yeah, and we could keep fighting those other fights. We can be trying to occupy America, occupy Wall Street. I'm all behind that 100%. But pick your battles one at a time. You know, I agree. It's you're not gonna. In fact, one of the main reasons pot is gaining as much ground legalization is because people with money starting to get behind it. And in a way, we should thank them, because without that, pot legal was just a bunch of hippies with signs in front of the Capitol. You know, nobody gets shit. You know, there's involved. No, I mean, about that, I'm obviously respect protesters and stuff. But the thing is, it lends a legitimacy in the minds and the wallets of average Americans and policymakers when there are companies putting money behind this and getting involved in it. It brings it to another level.
Yeah, and I understand the economic concerns, especially when you're starting to talk to people in Northern California and a lot of these local economies that have grown up around this cannabis trade as it's been. So I understand that. And if we need to understand, though, that cannabis is going to become a big business commodity, we just need to direct it toward the craft beer and wine model and less toward the cigarette kind of model.
Right.
And so we are doing that with Prop 64 because it creates these micro licenses where you can, micro business licenses, where you can be your own grower and seller and processor at the small kind of boutique level if you want to. It forestalls the development of grows over an acre, any of these big mega grows, for 5 years before that's going to start happening. So the existing growers can kind of get their foot in early and build their business. They got kind of a head start on that. And I really think it's going to turn out like craft beer. I'm here in Portland, Oregon, man. I could buy a Budweiser if I wanted to, but I don't think I could find one. Right?
But and why would you?
Why would I?
So many great boutique tastes and flavors available.
Exactly. And they've got this other part of Prop 64 that recognizes what they call regional appellations. This is your wine country thing. This is like where in France, if you want to sell champagne, or actually anywhere you want to sell champagne, it's got to come from the Champagne region of France. That's going to work for Humboldt, for Mendocino, for Trinity, for Emerald Triangle. All of these places are going to be able to brand their cannabis and have that brand protected and kind of exalted in the market. So this is a good thing if you're thinking from that small to medium size grower level. Yes, there's going to be big grows eventually, but there was always going to be big grows eventually. This is carving out a niche for some of those smaller growers.
Well, it sounds pretty fair and pretty like a pretty decent law. I mean, so, you know, other than the overarching objections that we mentioned earlier, the people who are worried about it hitting their pocketbook and the people who are just pure idealists who think it doesn't nearly go far enough, there are more specific criticisms of specific aspects of it that I'd like to run through real quickly.
All right.
One of which, and these are the ones that you debunked for the most part on your post, which you're on your High Times article, which is like, for instance, one, they claim that there is a jail time for a host of harmless offenses and offenses that didn't exist before that exist now, including possessing more than an ounce, which they say is 6 months in jail or a $500 fine, and teens and young adults ages 18 to 20 or 18 to 21 getting up to 6 months in jail and a $500 fine for simply sharing a joint. Now, is that accurate?
No. Here's what happens is when laws are written, they have to include what the current law is within the text of the new law that they're writing, you know, so they can show what they're amending, what's being changed, what's not being changed. Typically, in most states, they'll make the new stuff in italics and the old stuff is in regular print, or the new stuff's in boldface or all caps or whatever. They differentiate it somehow. Some of these people, these propagandists against 64, are taking that, not taking this text that exists already in the current law and saying that Prop 64 makes that happen. No, that's just restating what is currently the law. In almost every case, the current law, whatever it is, becomes either legal or a lesser penalty than what it was before. There's only a couple things that go up. One is the public, if you smoke weed in a non-smoking area, like a no tobacco non-smoking area, goes from a $100 fine to a $250 fine. And then possession of an open container in a car is a $250 fine that would have been punished by a $100 infraction ticket for possession back in the day. So a couple fines go up to $150. Otherwise, a whole bunch of felonies become misdemeanors. A few misdemeanors get their penalties reduced to infractions, and a few things that are currently illegal become legal.
Well, I mean, and if yes, you're not allowed to smoke in public, but if there are licenses being granted for smoke lounges and coffee shops and things, you would think there would be somewhere you could go to medicate and you wouldn't have a problem, right?
That's the development we hope. And of course, opponents will say, oh, well, there's all these places in California that are councils that are banning it and would never do it. Right. They're banning it now. And then they might ban it in the future. How does that make things any worse? Why would you stop some other community that might not ban it from moving forward on this?
Right. And then, of course, another criticism is we mentioned that of the six plants is just not enough to treat lots of serious ailments. People now have unlimited, and you're going from unlimited to six plants. So that's another criticism.
Not if you're a Prop 215 patient. If you're a patient or a grower for a patient, you still get to do what is medically necessary under Prop 215. There's nothing in 64 that repeals, amends, supersedes, or changes 215. And in fact, when it mentions that six plant limit, there's a little point that says, does not relate to the Compassionate Use Act of 1996. So it specifically says this is not the limit for patients.
So I think what people are worried about, and the, people are pointing to Washington State mm-hmm. and saying, look at what happened there. They had medical marijuana. Everything was fairly going smooth. They passed recreational, and look what happened. They shut the whole medical program down, and now it's a fiasco. Patients are screwed over, and they're saying the same thing is pretty much going to happen to California.
The lesson of Washington isn't that legalization kills medical marijuana. The lesson of Washington is get your medical marijuana regulated before you legalize. What was going on in Washington was a completely unregulated system of co-ops and storefront dispensaries that had popped up in illegally. They weren't registered or legal under the law. And a kind of a system where it was easy to get a recommendation, and there was a lot of people growing a lot of weed all over the state. And when that came up against, or it was put up next to the I-502 system that has taxes and regulations and inspections and everything that goes with that, that put the possibility of there being a market that had taxes and was regulated and therefore had higher prices running alongside a medical market that didn't have all that overhead. And the legislature decided, well, all that would do is lead people to game the medical marijuana system in order to get the tax break. So they've tried to merge the two. So what happens in California is different. Like you mentioned, they passed the Medical Marijuana Regulation and Safety Act, which is now called the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act, MCRSA. So they've got their regulations in place. They've done the changes to the medical marijuana system that were necessary in California to avoid some of these abuses. And another thing that's different, and this is something that's pointed out by the opponents as a flaw that is really kind of, in a strange way, a benefit, and that is the tax. They point out that there's a 15% excise tax and a $9.25 per ounce cultivation tax that even the medical marijuana patients will have to pay. Now, they don't have to pay state sales tax and such or local tax, but this new excise tax they'll have to pay. And I will agree, on its face, that is immoral. We should not tax people's medicine. But here's the trade-off. In California, anybody who wants to get a card can get one. Whether you got cancer or a hangnail, you can get a card. So we'd have that same situation like Washington. If patients got a tax break, the legislature would go, oh, look at this medical system that's all this tax break that all these people are gaming to go in and get their tax break, and we're losing money on the rec side. Let's merge them. Let's get rid of medical. So in a sense, the 15% tax is kind of a payoff to the legislature to keep medical as easy as it is to access. Now, the fear is the plant or the costs go up, the price goes up. But if you look up here in Oregon and Washington, we've got taxes of 37% in Washington. We got taxes of 20% here in Oregon. And our cannabis prices are far lower than what you're finding in the California dispensaries right now. There may be an initial price raise, initial spike in prices, but the legalization in California is going to create so much production, so much competition, that the prices we see 5 years from now, we could see $100 ounces, $75 ounces, even with the taxes. And in the long run, that would be better for patients.
Wow. Yeah. And in a way, the way you just phrased that argument, the tax on the patients on the medicine actually, in a way, serves to bolster the patients, the Prop 215 rights and situation, because of what you're saying. It, rather than everybody flooding into the medical to game it to save on the tax, the people who are getting medical will be the people who legitimately are patients and legitimately do need medical, as opposed to people trying to game it, because those people will just go to the regular dispensaries.
Yeah, most of the people that are in California visiting or just regular old tokers are getting their card for arrest anxiety syndrome or ticket and anxiety syndrome. One of the two. They want to grow or they want to just possess, but they really just don't want to get arrested. When weed's legal and that threat goes away, a lot of these people that have been going to see the doctor every year to get their recommendation aren't going to do it anymore. They got a place to shop. They can possess weed. They can grow weed. They're cool with it. So yeah, the people that do go back and get their recommendations are going to have to be the people that legitimately need more than an ounce, need to have a lot of possession, need to be able to grow a lot of plants. And that can only be good for medical marijuana by re-legitimizing it in the eyes of the public.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if we missed any of the criticisms. I think we addressed most of them. Is there anything I missed that you can think of, or?
Yeah, the new crimes is the one of them. Again, everything, when they say that there's a new crime created, ask them what the penalty is now. Ask them what would be the law now. And almost every time, what they're saying is going to happen is what happens now. That's one of them. I think we got them all.
Cool. Well, you've convinced me.
Well, thank you.
I know how I'm going to be voting on Election Day next week here in California. I hope that all of these initiatives are able to pass in the states where they are, and I hope that we see a huge progressive move, leap forward for cannabis in the United States. You know, I thought cannabis might have been before all this insanity with Trump got heavy. I really thought cannabis was going to be a bigger issue in the presidential election and the debates. I thought it was going to be a topic that was going to be heavily discussed, but Trump just sucked all the air out of that argument. I mean, it's just amazing to me that this is where we're at in our politics, that we have this person as the nominee. I mean, what would a Trump presidency mean for legalization? I think it would be a disaster.
Yeah, and people need to recognize that the president's gig is really one of bureaucracy. It's really one of staffing the executive branch, staffing all these cabinet positions, these departments, these bureaus, and of course, judges as well. So think back to George W. Bush and that guy's determination that an Arabian horse show judge should run the Federal Emergency Management Association. A horse show judge should run FEMA. And look what that did to New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit, when they were incompetent and incapable of helping people dying in our streets, drowning in New Orleans. That's what can happen when an incompetent president makes an incompetent pick for a very critical federal department. So imagine a Donald Trump picking the attorney general, the head of the DEA, the head of the ONDCP, Treasury,
Supreme Court nominees.
Finance. Yeah, I mean, disaster, right? Trump himself might not give a shit about marijuana. He might think it's fine. He might not care. He might not care, right? But the people he picks will probably care because he has already been on record. When they reached out to Huckabee, Donald Trump Jr. said that basically the vice president would be in charge of everything domestic and foreign while Donald was making America great again. So the vice president might be doing a lot of this. And Mike Pence, look that guy up. Oh, my God. This guy is retrograde.
Yeah. Well, Michael Moore is convinced Trump's going to win. I sincerely hope he's wrong. What do you think? Do you think I don't think he's going to win.
I don't think he's going to win, but I don't think his followers are going anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's what worries me. I think the way the Electoral College is stacked up against him, I can't see him pulling 270 electoral votes. The scenario I fear at this point is enough third party defection to pull Hillary Clinton down into just a plurality win. Like her husband, when he won in 92, he only got 43% of the vote because there was Perot and Bush he was running against. So if she gets in with like 43 and Trump got, say, 40, then all these Trumpkins are going to say how close it was and how 57% of the country didn't want Hillary Clinton. And there we go. We're all back to gridlock.
Yeah, and something tells me that even if he loses, Trump is not going to go gently into that good night. He's going to contest. He's going to continue to be a big mouth and try to influence. Look at the Palin effect, Sarah Palin. You know, after the election was over, she was still blathering on, making no sense in the media for months and months and months, years even, pretending to have credibility and trying to affect policy and public, you know, discourse. And it was a disaster. Thankfully, she has faded from any relevance and she's now a curiosity. Let's hope that the same thing happens to Trump.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Russ, I wish you a lot of luck with your election night coverage. I will definitely be tuning in and checking it out. I'm curious and real excited to see what happens with all the cannabis races. Let everybody know where they can find you online and see and hear you.
Yeah, my show, The Russ Belville Show, is on weekdays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on CannabisRadio.com. It's been called the NPR of POT. We get talk radio and news and interviews and analysis and rants. It's great stuff every weekday. The election night coverage will be on Tuesday, November 8th at 3 p.m. Pacific. We're running for 6 hours because we got to cover all the different time zones. We're going to have campaign spokespeople, celebrities, athletes, opponents even, a bunch of people to talk to, policy experts as well. Check that out on Marijuana Election Night, hashtag MJ Election Night on CannabisRadio.com.
Awesome. Awesome. You know, how do I get my podcast on Cannabis Radio and 420 Radio, man? I need to be on there.
we'll do it. Well, I will just I will forward that request to our producers. I'm sure they'd love to have you. We got Dr. Mitch Earlywine. We got Vivian McPeak, Kyle Cushman. You'd fit right in.
Yeah, I've been a guest on Kyle's show and Vivian's show. I need to be a guest on your show. How can I call in on election night?
Hell yeah, we can work that out. Absolutely.
Cool. Well, I'd love to be a part of it. As I'm sure you know, politics is definitely a huge passion of mine. I care. I follow politics the way most guys follow sports.
Yeah.
Did you
mention you were in Southern California?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we're doing our election night coverage at the DoubleTree downtown Los Angeles. Maybe we can just get you in.
Oh, that would be cool. Let me see if I'm able to get up there. That'd be awesome. Cool. Well, Russ, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today and helping us sort out this mess of the Cali legalization law, and also just helping us educate all of our listeners on what's going on in the country and how they should be voting on elections. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Bobby.
All right. Well, take care, man. Cool. Thanks.